This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
African countries are in an unfortunate position where they'll probably be the last people to receive these treatments if we don't change our system to ensure that there is diversified manufacturing companies and also ensure that there's competition to allow for more affordability.
That's Candice Sihoma, the advocacy officer for Doctors Without Borders, on the need to ensure that Africa gets equal access to a COVID-19 vaccine. Details coming up also. Pressure is mounting in Mali as the country's political crisis drags on. And the latest talks involving Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan regarding the Renaissance Dam have broken down. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a group of French nationals along with their guide and a driver were ambushed and killed in a wildlife park in Niger yesterday. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but France and other countries have warned people against traveling in parts of Niger where militants operate, including Boko Haram and an affiliate of Islamic State. International Edition's Steve Miller gets the latest from Paris-based journalist Catherine Field.
What we know is that this group of aid workers set off from the capital, Niamey, early in the morning after dawn, as per the protocols for leaving the capital. They headed southeast to this giraffe reserve, which is a very famous reserve in Niger because it's the home of the last of the West African giraffes. It's had great success in restocking the giraffes in that area. What happened next, we really don't know. All we know is they were on the road. They got to the park entrance on time. They were safe. Once they went inside the park area, they stopped in an area, and it was there that they were ambushed. They were shot. Their car was set on fire, and their bodies just left at the side of the vehicle, apart from one who tried to escape and was caught. We then know that the alarm was raised. Soldiers from the French military went to the scene. They tried to find some of the assailants. There are reports that they did find some of them. But in the meantime, that's all we know. The bodies of the aid workers, their guide and the driver are now back in Niamey, and investigations are continuing.
Speaking of investigations, what are the French looking into and what are authorities in Niger doing?
In Niger at the moment, the bodies are now at the morgue in Niamey. The French military and the local officials in Niger are carrying out a post-mortem. They have opened an investigation into the attack. Also on the ground, there are still French forces on the ground, Barkhane forces there operating in that giraffe reserve to try and find whatever evidence they can. Also, we've got a whole team of forensic experts on the ground there. Here in Paris, the French president is convening his Security Defense Council Tuesday morning. He'll be wanting to know more about what has happened. And he'll be also questioning, how did this happen? What was going on? If there are so many more troops now from the French armed forces in that area between Niger, Burkina Faso and Mali, how did this happen? That's happening as well. We're also seeing the French anti-terror prosecutors opening an investigation into this. So that will be important because there will be one prosecutor getting together all this evidence to see what lessons can be learned.
Catherine, what kind of information has been released about the victims?
We know that the youngest was age 25, the eldest was 50 years old, and that would have been the park guide who was the president of the Giraffe Guide Center there. And the other was the driver. He was age 50, married with two children. We know that of the Europeans who were there, there were four women and two men. Some of them were volunteers for this NGO. They had only been in the country several weeks. However, the NGO itself has said that these weren't complete beginners, that they had been through a period of 6 months training here in Paris before they went out there. When they're out there, this group that is based in Niamey are not the actual aid workers who look after the displaced people in the outskirts of the country. These are the administrative staff who are based in the capital.
That was Paris-based journalist Catherine Field speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. In Mali, pressure is mounting as the country's political crisis drags on with no progress. The main opposition figure, Imam Mahamud Diko, suggested yesterday that France has moved behind the scene to protect President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. For VOA News, Nicolas Pinot reports from Paris.
Speaking at a news conference in the capital Bamako, Diko accused France of interfering in the choice of prime minister for Mali. The religious leader said Prime Minister Boubou Cissé, whom he asked to resign in a face-to-face confrontation late last month, had no legitimacy in Mali's civil society. Cissé has stayed on as the political impasse deepens, and Diko alleged it is France that is behind Ibeka in these decisions, using the acronym by which Mali's president Ibrahim Boubacar Keita is known. I am not an enemy of France, but France must respect us, Diko insisted. Diko, who is considered the figurehead of the opposition June 5 movement, offered no proof for the accusation of interference. Last month, heads of government of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, urged the formation of a unity government, among other measures, to calm the crisis. The African leaders stuck by Keita, however. The June 5 movement quickly rebuffed the proposals, insisting on Keita's resignation. Diko said a radical change of governance is needed and that the opposition will not back down. He added that he hopes an anti-Keita rally scheduled for tomorrow will be inscribed in history. This is Nicolas Pinault reporting from Paris.
The latest talks involving Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan on the Nile River Dam have broken down due to disagreement over new Ethiopian guidelines on filling the massive project. Sudan's Ministry of Irrigation and Water Resources said the guidelines only covered the first filling, which already has taken place. Egypt said the guidelines lacked rules for operating the dam and violated past agreements. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed this hurdle with Hamdi Abdul-Rahman, professor of political science at Cairo University.
I think there is a kind of political tensions and a misguided analysis regarding the tripartite talks. It is going on now for a decade, and it will be a long battle. It is not an easy negotiation because it reflects a clash of national interest. If you look at Egypt, Egypt relies heavily on the Nile, and it believes in its historical rights, and it is a matter of life or death. For Ethiopia, it considered the historical injustice and its right to develop and prosper using its own water. So here, a kind of clash. This creating a political atmosphere not in favor of reaching a deal. This is why you have a pressure, a kind of populist discourse, either in Egypt or in Sudan. When you are sitting the negotiating table, you should create a kind of political atmosphere to facilitate the agreement. But I think now we are in a chicken dilemma situation where the zero-sum game is a favorite, which is, I think, a main obstacle to reaching a fair deal. I'm not believing in the water war. If you go to history, I think cooperation rather than conflict will prevail at the end.
The talks are observed by the African Union, South Africa, the United States, and the European Union. What could the observers do after Egypt and Sudan suspended their participation in the GERD talks?
You see, there is here a kind of wise movement from both Egypt and Sudan, because in spite of the unilateral first filling by Ethiopia, they agreed to continue talks under the supervision of the African Union. Now, the maneuver from Ethiopia, as usual, I'm not surprised about that, brought us back to square number one. They started saying, after the resumption of talks and the second Africa mini-summit meeting, decided on the principle of what kind of a deal, a binding legal deal, treating the concerns of all three parties, including the mitigation of droughts and how to compensate this, and also how to manage the future disputes. And the third issue, I think, is the future project on the Blue Nile. But Ethiopia, after the resumption, the first day of the talks, brought us to what we call it a piecemeal approach. A piecemeal approach is you are not negotiating over a comprehensive deal, but a partial one. And what is surprising here, that Ethiopia tried this one on April, Sudan refused that, and Egypt refused any partial agreement. So I think the same maneuver practiced by Ethiopia again. Here, in my opinion, the role of the observer. I have some doubts about how effective the African Union is, because historically it has no experience, it has no logistics how to deal with these highly technical issues like the Nile water, and also because the African Union used to keep away from these sensitive issues. The African Union, by the end of the day, is a forum, not a kind of law enforcement. So the United States threatened to have a kind of aid cut to Ethiopia. So you need to put more pressure in Ethiopia to come back to the line of compromise. So I think U.S. still has a role. Also, China is a major party stakeholder in the GERD because it's finance and it's ruling the construction of the GERD. And also, China is an important international player, has a problem with its neighbor, a water problem. So we have to keep an eye on China. There is a hope that putting more pressure on Ethiopia could facilitate to reach a fair deal and to make GERD as a regional project for the whole region.
That was Hamdi Abdullah Rahman, professor of political science at Cairo University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Thousands of Mauritanians are scrambling around the clock to mop up oil that leaked from a grounded Japanese ship on their pristine Indian Ocean beaches. According to Reuters, the MV Wakshi, owned by Nagashiki Shipping Company and operated by Mitsubishi OSK Line, began oozing fuel into the turquoise seawaters last week after hitting a reef off the island. Mauritius Prime Minister Pravin Jugnauth has declared a state of emergency and appealed for international help. He said the spill represents a danger for the country of 1.3 million people that relies heavily on tourism and has been hurt by travel restrictions caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Former colonial ruler France has sent aid in what environmental group Greenpeace said could be a major ecological crisis. In Japan, officials of the ship owner apologized yesterday and said they have sent experts to Mauritius to join in the cleanup effort. The international health rights group Doctors Without Borders is concerned that many Africans could be deprived of the COVID-19 vaccine when it eventually is developed. It says much of Africa's already without access to personal protective equipment and coronavirus test kits simply because it cannot afford them. Darren Taylor reports.
Under the traditional trade system, one manufacturer secures a patent to monopolize the production of a particular medicine and gets to charge what it wants for that treatment. Doctors Without Borders Africa Advocacy Officer Candice Sehoma says such profiteering from a global pandemic would be despicable.
These originator companies or pharmaceuticals would price the medicine out of reach for people who need it the most. So this means that countries in Africa who have very limited health budgets, that means they would have to take away a very big portion of their budget to purchase these life-saving medication. Another thing is that...
In the past, she says, rich countries got vaccines first because they had financial muscle, leaving diseases to rage across poor regions.
African countries are in an unfortunate position where they'll probably be the last people to receive these treatments if we don't change our system to ensure that there is diversified manufacturing companies and also ensure that there's competition to allow for more affordability so that countries in Africa would be better placed to purchase these life-saving medication and diagnostics.
Sarah Holmer urges the World Health Organization to facilitate equal access to COVID-19 treatment by using its power to issue so-called compulsory drug manufacturing licenses. These would override traditional trade practice.
What essentially does is that it allows for competition and the affordability of a certain treatment, and allows for a locally based sort of manufacturer to be able to manufacture that specific drug without the permission of the patent holder.
Batse Homa emphasizes that not all international drug and medical equipment conglomerates are unscrupulous and dedicated solely to profits. South Africa, for example, is now producing its own ventilators with the help of a few such firms that have put morals before money, as she puts it.
To be able to produce our own ventilators, certain companies or originator companies needed to sort of share their recipes to allow for South Africa to be able to produce. So I think that's the kind of solidarity that we need, that in as much as countries have limited production capacities, but what they can do is share recipes and know-how, knowledge on how to produce such to allow for countries to be able to locally produce on their own.
So Homa maintains that if the world is to beat COVID-19, its vaccine must not be patented.
We need to also just move away from commodifying access to healthcare and ensure that for us to really combat COVID-19, we would need to come together. And one of the ways we need to come together is to ensure that everyone has equitable access to these life-saving treatment or vaccines. And that would mean that...
She says it's in the world's best interests to ensure this happens. Sehoma says the coronavirus has no borders and has shown that this is a time in history for globalism, not narrow-minded nationalism.
We do need each other in this case, and I think COVID-19 actually is making that more and more apparent, and we're so connected with each other. And I think if we just focus on our own and don't ensure that others stand to benefit from this, there won't be an end to this.
She wants the African Union to be much stronger than it has been so far in presenting a united continental front in the battle for equal access to COVID-19 treatment and equipment. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Malawi's new president, Lazarus Chakwera, says he is working on proposing legislation aimed at trimming his presidential powers in an effort to empower the citizens. In his national address Sunday, Chakwera said, "Having a president who makes too many decisions has created problems in Malawi, and this has led to government mismanagement in the past." Lamek Basina reports from Blantyre.
Trimming presidential powers was among the campaign promises President Chakwera made during political rallies that helped him defeat former President Peter Mutharika during the June 23 presidential election rerun. In his national address Saturday, Chakwera said the president has too much appointing authority and responsibilities that he says bring him into conflict. He says having a presidency that makes too many decisions has created problems for our country for a long time. Chief among them is that it has stifled a culture of responsibility and innovation among public institutions and private citizens. Chakwera compared the running of government to how parents run family affairs. He says even as parents in our homes, we know that rigidly concentrating too much decision-making power in the parents hinders a child's ability to develop critical life skills. This is a mistake we must stop making at a national level. Chakwera faulted the present arrangement, which puts the president as an appointing authority for top positions in the judiciary, legislature, executive, boards of statutory corporations, foreign embassies, and traditional leadership. He says this is unwise. No person is good or humble enough to be entrusted with that much appointing power, for it is not possible for a president to be the appointing authority of that many offices without at some point coming face to face with a conflict of interest. Social commentator Humphrey Mvula recommends the move, saying excess presidential power has long made the presidents in Malawi not accountable to anyone.
They have done what is their sole wish. They have employed the colonies, relatives, homemates, tribesmen, and the all manner of individuals, because there is no vetting process. They have decided to vary rules, regulations, at whim.
Critics argue reducing powers would render the president useless if he just becomes a mere rubber stamp at the expense of prison citizens. However, Edgar Nyongolo, a legal expert at the University of Malawi, disagrees. He says trimming presidential powers is the only thing Malawi could do to consolidate its democracy.
People who are talking about maybe a president could become a rubber stamp, I suspect they may be people who are more inclined towards an authoritarian president who exercises a heavy hand. And I think that is inconsistent with democracy. So I think that it is not true to say that limiting the powers of the president renders the presidency powerless.
In the meantime, Chakwera has asked Malawians to demand their members of parliament to vote for the changes once the proposed legislation is presented in parliament. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
As Nigeria's COVID-19 cases continue to rise, the national government has directed federal civil servants to undergo tests for the virus as part of efforts to slow the spread of the pandemic. The country already has recorded nearly 45,000 cases and nearly 1,000 deaths. From Abuja, Nigeria, Gifta Gariga has more.
The directive says the government has made available testing facilities where staff members experiencing COVID-19-related symptoms can get tested free. Those without symptoms also can get tested. Abubakar Ahasan Yakubu is the chairperson of the Nigeria Labour Congress, Abuja, and applauds the government's action.
It's all for the good of all of us, so that people get to work and they are very sure they are safe. And those colleagues of theirs in their work environment are also safe.
Yakubu, however, expressed doubts about whether the government can acquire enough testing kits to carry out the program.
I'm not sure even the quantum of workers at the federal level can all be tested. I'm not sure the federal government have the capacity to do that.
The government's directive on civil service employees makes no mention of whether private sector employees also will be able to get free tests. Dr. Austin Maho, a publisher and journalism teacher in Abuja, advised the private sector employers to imitate the federal government by ensuring their staff get tested.
I think the private sector should equally cater for their staff. I know that staff welfare is an integral part of the working condition in private sector. We are all in this together.
One civil servant, Abdul Fatai Bello, says the government should ensure that workers observe COVID-19 protocols when they come for the testing.
Being that all hands must be on deck to fight this scourge of COVID-19, steps must be taken to ensure that even while going for those tests, precaution is taken.
As Africa's biggest economy, the Nigeria government has imposed nationwide regulations to curtail the spread of the virus. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiji Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.